I had put everyone's introductions onto the wiki, and now I can't get on the internet, so I'm going to say what I remember about you guys, and if I miss something really critical that you'd like to share, please feel free to add along with that. I want to thank Denise, first of all, came down, or up, I guess, because Baltimore is south, so that equals down. To come and talk to us about the work that they've been doing at DreamWidth. I think it's been mentioned already twice today, 75% women developers. So clearly something good is going on at DreamWidth, and we'll be able to learn a little bit about that. Erin Clark also came out from the Bay Area. She does a lot of work with the Tor project, and is it proper to say you're one of the co-founders of Debian Women? Or
I'm the primary founder of Debian
Women. Primary founder. The primary founder. Okay, fantastic. And then Chris Ball, who's done a lot of work on OLPC, and do you have other things I should say?
No, that's fine.
Okay, and is coming to share some of the work that they've been doing on that project. And then Hannah, also from Debian Women, and our local woman here, is also, we're happy to have you here as well. Did I say anything else about you?
No,
that's
cool.
Okay, great. I have a couple questions, and so just to sort of get started, and so we'll start there, but feel free to interpret or build upon the questions there. Denise, the first question I have, I'll let you start with, is can you talk about some of the ways that you've created a culture at DreamWidth that is welcoming and effective at retaining women, and some specific ways?
Well, the fact that we are 75% women honestly startled us. Social documentation of what people were expected to behave like, how people were expected to interact with each other on the project, and specifically how to handle conflicts and problems. And a lot of that really went very far towards creating a welcoming and open environment for people to learn in.
Awesome. And so my next question is for Hannah. Can you talk about some of the ways that you changed your outreach or your outreach strategy to do a better job of making sure that women feel invited to your project?
Yeah. So I guess the thing that I want to talk about is the GNOME Women's Summer Outreach Program, which Chris and I started and ran in 2006. And the reason why we did this was that year GNOME had 181 applicants for Google Summer of Code, and not a single one of them was a woman. And so Chris came to me and said, this is a problem. And I said, yes, okay. So we put together the GNOME Women's Summer Outreach Program to try and, basically we wanted to get more women involved in GNOME, and so we created three positions for women to work with mentors at GNOME, doing basically the same kind of stuff that people were doing with the Summer of Code project. And the main thing we actually did, so it ended up being a huge success. We had something like over 200 women send us emails and something like about 100 applicants, or maybe a little less than 100 applicants, which was really quite startling given that Summer of Code had previously had 181 applicants and not a single one was from a woman. And we think that the thing that made the biggest difference was actually changing the way in which we described the program. So basically, Summer of Code was advertised by Google as sort of more of a, are you the best, prove you're the best, you know, get involved, show what you can do kind of thing. And what we did was run a basically identical program, you know, so students were working with mentors, working over the summer, same kind of thing, and we were just much more basically upfront about, you know, would you like to get involved? Would you like to work with a mentor? You know, we'll help you get involved with GNOME, learn more about free software development. And that seemed to make a really big difference, just changing that language from sort of like, you know, are you the best, prove you're the best kind of thing, to being more kind of, would you like to work with a mentor? Please, you know, get involved. No, sorry. When we advertised the GNOME Women's Summer Outreach Program, in the language that we used to advertise that particular program, we made sure that the language was much more that kind of thing. Inviting, that is the word that I'm looking for.
I think one way to phrase it might be that it was phrased in a cooperative way rather than a competitive way.
Yep.
You get the impression that with Google Summer of Code, you're competing to be one of the people in the spots if they get a petition. We were very much more laid back, like, hey, how would you like to get a mentor, find out how this new software thing works, work on new Linux desktop applications?
That's the other thing. We sent a huge number of personalized emails. Basically, so this is actually the single thing that I think surprised me, I guess, the most, which was that we sent a huge number of personalized emails to people. So to people we knew in universities, to people we knew at companies, you know, basically anywhere, saying, do you know female students who might want to apply for this? And I think that made a huge difference. I've seen this with other projects as well. Personalized emails, just massive difference.
Great, thanks. So my next question is for Chris. Can you talk about some of the benefits, either expected or unexpected, of increasing the number of women involved with your project?
Sure. So there's an obvious benefit associated with having more women in GNOME, which is that we're trying to design a desktop environment for the entire world, and it seems hard to imagine that a group of mostly white men could work out what it is that everyone needs from their computing. So when we try to invite more women into the group, we're doing it because we think it's actually going to result in much better software for our users.
Cool. And then, so we had a telephone conversation before we did the panel, and Aaron, I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about the phrase lowering barriers to participation.
Yeah, so I hate that phrase, because over the course of the conversation that we had on the phone, it became very clear relatively quickly that there wasn't really any barrier lowering happening. I mean, the entry into free software projects is roughly the same no matter which door you go through, which is that you start by writing a two-line patch or some very short program. This is true for men, it's true for women as well. The difference seems to be that the women I had known, I can't of course speak for all women, is that they're just a little more cooperative. They want to work with someone maybe to write that first patch. They don't come in and kind of do it as like this lone wolf scenario, but they have to learn how to file bugs just like men. They have to learn how to write these patches and find projects to get involved with. It just seems like the way to get them to do that is slightly different. It doesn't seem like, you know, it's not the kind of situation where free software women are required to carry handguns while the men get to carry M16s. It's not like there's no actual physical barrier that is happening. They're not being required to do 25 push-ups instead of 100. I mean, it's the same exact work. That's not a phrase I like.
Awesome. And then the last question that I have, and then I'll take questions from the audience, and this is sort of to everyone who wants to comment a little bit. So we've heard the idea of a code of conduct mentioned already, but if you can talk about, for your own specific work, like what's been like really, what kinds of things were really effective in that code of conduct and some of the ways that changed the culture at your project?
Well, the first thing that we said right up front was that we were specifically interested in pursuing diversity because of what Chris said. You know, the more voices you have input on, the better your final product is. So we actually sat down and wrote a diversity statement that specifically addressed all of the different points of diversity that we wanted to sort of appeal to. And actually, if you go Google diversity statement, I think we're the number two hit because people just liked ours so much that they've been linking to it and using it. And it is Creative Commons licensed, so if you want to use it for your project, please feel free. So naming the axes of diversity really helped for us because it made people looking at our diversity statement say, hey, that's me. And so there was more of that moment of recognition, like, hey, they are specifically mentioning neurodiversity in their diversity statement. That means that they might be more aware of issues that somebody on the autistic or Asperger spectrum might encounter while developing with you guys. So that was one of the things we did. And one of the other things that we did specifically was made it very, very clear right up front that as a point of project culture, making mistakes was okay. And that's something that a lot of people have said that they haven't seen in other free software projects. Other projects may have sort of the idea that, oh, a patch that doesn't compile or doesn't fully fix the bug or whatever is a flaw because it means that somebody else's time is being used to review this patch, to check it in, and because it didn't work completely, then it was just, you know, a waste of everybody's time and why are you even bothering? And that's the kind of thing that really drives people away, whereas we made it a point right up front to say, if somebody gives us a patch that's 80% of the way there to fixing the issue, then that's 80% of work that we didn't have to do. And it's an opportunity to sit down with the person who authored the patch and tell them, okay, here is what's wrong with things, here is how it can improve, here's how you can do it better next time. And then they'll be willing to turn around and give that sort of same help to somebody else a little later on.
And I think we never had really a diversity statement within Debian Women, but one of the things that we did do was recognize relatively early on that there were going to be different types of personalities that we were encountering. I personally am not of the extremely timid persuasion, and that there are plenty of women and people in general who are. And so when we would get new people, of course they would sometimes have problems. Maybe they were like a little scared of a mailing list when they needed encouragement or something like that. And basically we had different people, of which Hannah was one, who you could talk to if you had a problem. And it was, I think, pretty explicit on our website. Like, if you have a problem with a person or a mailing list or you have a technical question, you can talk to these people. And the people who were maybe like a little more reverent or like tough or something might want to talk to me, but or they might want to talk to Hannah, or they might want to talk to another woman, Helen, who's very prominent in Debian Women. And we all kind of had different personality types, and we could all sort of work with different personalities as well. And I think that made a big difference. In addition to that, we also had our IRC channel was it was like the hub. Mm-hmm. And we did have an IRC etiquette page because all too often we would have trolls, of course. Any women's group attracts trolls. But those were not the bad ones. The bad ones were basically well-meaning people who would dominate the channel. They were often men, not always, but we basically had an IRC etiquette page that we could say, look, you're doing these things, please go read this and then come back. And it was sort of like, it was almost like the Feminism 101 website in the sense that it was like, here's a set of certain behaviors that we're just not going to go over with you. We're not going to educate you. We've written a thing, you can read that and then come back and talk to us. And so I think that helped eliminate some of the mires that you can get into with these discussions that you repeat over and over and over again. But there was no really official code of conduct or anything like mm-hmm. that, but I think we mostly became pretty well.
I love the idea of a diversity statement because if nothing else, it's a public statement from you that your current lack of diversity is a bug. we're asking the question, you know, how come there's only 2% of women? And we really don't know the answer. There are a lot of answers. It's quite complicated. But one of the answers to why are there only 2% of women is a feedback loop related answer. There are so few women because there are so few women. And if you imagine a project the size of Debian when Erin and Hannah and everyone else were starting Debian Women, there were maybe 600 participants at the time in Debian, pretty much all men, I think.
Actually, there were over 900.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and so the figure I like to give is that, like, within the first year or two, we increased the women's participation by 800%. That's only 10 women. And that is more than the project had seen in its previous, like, 12 or 13 years of existence.
So if you imagine being someone looking in on Debian from the outside, I don't mean to pick on Debian, it's just the example that we're familiar with, and it's a room with 900 men in, and you're wondering whether you want to join this room, and you're a woman, why is that an attractive thing for you to do? It's not clear that you're wanted there, that there's some reason that there haven't been women there before, you just don't know. The fact that you're willing, that with a diversity statement, you can be willing to come out and say, hey, look, I've got no idea what's going on here, but there's no women. We'd really like there to be. We think it's an important part of our community that we want to encourage. So, yeah, I think a diversity statement is a great idea. It really lowers the bar to entering that room with 900 people in. Once you have just a few women, once you have a small Debian Women project, for example, you're creating role models that are incredibly important in matters like diversity. If you have someone who you can watch and say, I see this person, she's doing awesome stuff, I'd like to be doing that too. I think it makes things so much easier.
Yeah, so I just want to make one other point. Basically, other people have sort of covered pretty much everything I would want to say about that. But I want to make one other point about diversity, which is that one of the things that we did in Debian Women was to say that men could get involved in Debian Women, and which is a different kind of diversity, I guess. And this actually made a really, really big difference, I think, because women who got involved in Debian via Debian Women would meet these men who were actually, for the most part, really high up in the project, people who were doing really important things. They would get to know these men within the context of Debian Women and then encounter them in other areas of the project, which then made them feel as if they knew people, there were friendly faces around in that kind of sea of 900 guys. So actually, diversity of genders within Debian Women was really, really important.
And just to go back to that point of what both Chris and Hannah were saying, one thing that we did that really, really worked well was we have a program where people who want to hack on our code can actually get a hosted developer environment on our servers so that they don't have to go and work out all the dependencies and stuff, since we're a web application. And we actually have one person who runs that entire project and that entire program, and she's sort of like the newcomer welcome wagon. So people who are coming into the project take a look, they're like, okay, they have this program for me to come and get the resources that I need in order to start hacking, and then there's this person here whose job it is just to interact with new people and people who are just starting out. And so there's always that dedicated point of contact, and they always know where to go. And that's really helped.
And to sort of add on to that, one of the things that I think was also very successful in Debian Women very early on was to really give the new women technical tasks to do. I mean, they didn't want to come, mostly I found that they didn't want to come there and like talk about their feelings. Like, what they wanted was something to do. And if you would give them like specific things to do, I mean, and sometimes this was to the extent of saying, here's your commit access. And maybe they were nervous, and you just say, look, you can make a mistake, that's fine, but here's your commit access, make a change. If it's broken, then you fix it, no big deal. And build up from there. One of the things we also did was on Software Freedom Day one year. Do you remember which year? 2005 probably?
I think 2006.
Possibly 2006. We had a big Software Freedom Day event in which we set up a duplicate of the Debian bug tracking system, because we found a lot of people were like scared to file bugs. Just because like the bug tracking system for Debian is all done via email, and I guess it could be intimidating. I don't know. So we set up a duplicate bug tracking system. We set up the infrastructure you would use to upload packages to Debian. We set up an auto builder so that you could like upload a package and see it through the auto build process, and then see when it made it into the archive and you had practice using the tools before you like became a Debian developer. You could file bugs against like pretend packages. try to manipulate those bugs, assigning severity and so on. And often they would just want specific tasks within other parts of Debian to do. And like really, once you kind of told them, well, like, here's your goal, and here's an objective way to measure that goal. Once you have completed this task, then you have succeeded, and we're here to help you. That, I think, was really helpful for a lot of people because, like I said, they didn't want to just sit around and like talk about how they were marginalized. They wanted to do work.
We do that too. We have a rule in the project that no matter how small the thing that you've spotted that you want to change is, you file a bug for it. You know, if there's something that's been annoying you for a while and you keep thinking, someday I'll get around to fixing this, you know, file a bug for it. If it's a two-line change, file a bug for it. If it's, we actually have had file bugs to change literally one character in a particular file. And we make sure that we flag all of those bugs as requiring less effort than, you know, something way more complex so that newcomers can look specifically at a list of stuff that's newcomer friendly. Mm-hmm.
It's probably worth mentioning here, of course, none of this is specific or unique to women, right? It's the changes that we're talking about here. Yes, they open it up for women. They also open it up for men who might also be timid at the idea of sending email to the Linux kernel mailing list or filing a Debian bug. They're changes that improve our project for everyone.
And that's actually with DreamWidth, we've noticed that we've gotten a lot of men and a lot of experienced free software developers basically saying, oh wow, I've been looking for a project where everybody is going to be friendly and get along. So we've had a lot of people coming in and coming to hack with us just because they specifically do like project culture so much.
Yeah, we had that happen with Debian women a lot too. And I think eventually, you know, like at this point, a lot of the women have. So and at this point, we have a lot of women in various big parts of the project. I mean, a lot of them have just kind of, you know, left the nest, so to speak. And now even one of them, who originally came in through Debian Women, is running for the Debian project leader. So it's been, I think, pretty successful.
And the more that you have people who come in through programs like this, the more that they'll then turn around and help others, and it gets built into your project culture over time.
Cool. I'm going to open it up to the floor, so if people have questions on any of the stuff that's been discussed already or some aspect of working on recruiting and retaining at your project that hasn't been discussed, go show me your hand. Okay, Chris.
Accessibility project team, and you know, that's something that's really helped us because we have these people who do need assistive technology of some sort, or you know, who are living with disability of you know, visual or body problems, or you know, just chronic pain, things like that. So having the commitment to accessibility and building it into the project and also into the application means that people who need those accessibility technologies will be there using your project, and then will be willing to tell you all the ways in which you can make it even better. So, you know, an upfront committed statement committing to accessibility for people with disabilities has really helped us out there.
Is that open to the insight?
It's a project called DreamWidth. It's a open source free software fork of livejournal.com. LiveJournal over the years sort of drifted away from their free software roots, so we took it, we forked it, and we've been doing all sorts of fun things to it.
Yeah. As for Debian, we don't, I'm not sure that we have a specific project. And within Debian Women, we tried to make it very specific to women, but I think it was either explicit or at least implicit that we would be willing to help anyone who wanted to do something like that. We just didn't want to spread
scope creep.
Yeah, scope creep, exactly.
Cool. Is that Robert?
No, it's just that yours gave it to somebody.
Okay. Okay, great.
Cool. Other questions? Okay. One and then two. The woman here.
So with those about recruiting and less about retaining, do you have any thoughts about how to retain women or how to retain people?
The question was, we've heard a lot about recruiting and less about retaining. How do you retain the people from women and other minority groups? The thing that we found on the DreamWith project is that everybody likes to be noticed, and everybody likes to see their name in lights when they do something. So we make it a point of calling out first patches. We make it a point of when somebody has their first commit, we put that in our weekly newsletter. When somebody does something particularly big and showy that people have been wanting for a while, we put that in the weekly newsletter. And we also, every week, we can do this because our development weekly is probably about 20 to 50 commits. And what we'll do is highlight each and every one of those and say who did it, what it did, and whether or not it was specifically requested. And people like seeing their names mentioned there, and like getting people who say, "Oh wow, that bug's been annoying me for 6 months, and you fixed it." So people get a lot of love from the other developer community, and also from the user base when they see that their particular problem has just been patched, and that really helps keep people hacking on things.
So I wanted to add something to that, which is that. So there was a study done at CMU in order to find out, I guess, why there were so few women there on their undergraduate CS program. And one of the things they found out was that lack of confidence precedes lack of interest. So when people start losing interest and sort of dropping out of things, that's basically preceded by a lack of confidence. So I think if we really want to retain people, we really actually have to work on boosting people's confidence, making people feel appreciated and stuff like that, which really ties in with what you're saying. So
taking 5 minutes to say to somebody, wow, that's something that's been annoying me for a really long time, thank you so much for doing that, it just pays off incredibly well.
And I think that one of the things that we're for Debian, specifically, not Debian Women, but Debian, was when the women sort of started migrating to specific parts of the project, they began to care very deeply about their work. And I think that was really the main thing that's going to retain them. I mean, if you, assuming everything else is equal and you don't have anything working against them, basically the level of interest and engagement in the work that they're doing is what is going to keep them around long term. And so possibly just having interesting projects or finding out, you know, maybe what specifically about their personality is going to interest them in something else. That's one thing. But yeah, as soon as they got involved in like KDE and they had like their social circle as well as their like coworkers there, basically, that seemed to be the main thing that kept them around. I don't think that we were really so big on the accolades and stuff like that. But.
There's a particular challenge related to retaining when you have a separate group inside a larger group, like the GNOME Women's Summer Outreach Program was a small group inside GNOME, and Debian Women was a small group inside Debian. Retaining in that context often means sort of migrating from the small group to the large group. And it's hard to ensure that transition happens. For example, we had a Planet blog site for all of our GNOME Women's Summer Outreach Program students, and I know that Debian Women had a Planet Debian Women, I think.
No, we would just put women on Planet.
Well, that's good. I guess that's you want to try and keep the community small so that it can be an inviting community and a helpful one. But there's going to be a time where you're going to
push them out of the nest and see if they climb.
Right. And that's what retaining can mean, I think, in the context of a small project inside a larger one.
Awesome. And we had a question about, go ahead.
So you're right that this is the case. We decided not to talk about it too much today precisely because we're that self-selected group. We'd rather spend our time talking about the ways in which you can make your project more attractive to women once you've decided that that's something you want to do. We should certainly, when you read one of those posts that says, well, maybe women just aren't interested in computing, you should certainly reply and say, well, actually, it turns out that the Flosspol's report found that 22% of people working in proprietary software in industry and in academia are women, but only 2% are free software. So it can't be as simple as you explain. There must be something else going on.
And that's actually something that Chris has been really good about, is I think on several occasions, Chris has read...
I'm good at arguing with people.
Yeah. He's read posts like the sort that you're describing, and he's posted responses on his blog that have been very well reasoned and very well thought out. And I think that's a really, really great thing to do.
And there are other resources out there. I was actually going to compile a list for this panel, but the hotel I'm staying at has internet that cuts out on me every 3 seconds, so I didn't get a chance. But there are resources out there. There's the Finally Feminism 101 blog. There's the Geek Feminism blog. Those are the ones that come off the top of my head. And there have been debunkings of those particular arguments done over and over and over again. And there's a point, I think, at which we as a community don't need to be spending time on dealing with that 101 level of education. Just point people at the resources and say, here is, this has been answered before, go read the documentation, and then we're over here having the 201 conversation over here.
And in addition to that, I think that it's also okay to say to people, people who are interested and also possibly directly to those people, like, you don't care, too bad. You don't have to help. You don't, just don't interfere, right? That's basically all we need out of these people who are not stakeholders in this issue, is just leave us alone, you know? Because people who are interested will do their thing. And basically, these people can mostly ignore it, you know? And I mean, at some point you do need some buy-in from the community, but my experience with those kind of agitators is that you really, they don't do anything to just kind of talk. I mean, they don't usually block infrastructure. They don't usually, they'll just argue with you like on a mailing list or a blog or a Twitter or something like that. And so they can usually be pretty roundly ignored.
We had trouble ignoring it in the case of the GNOME Women's Summer Outreach Program, because it came up not in the abstract, but in the practical. We'd got these 181 applications that were all from men, and we wanted to run this program with 3 slots for women. And you wouldn't believe how often we heard, but what if you can't find 3 women? I mean, after all, you just showed that there aren't any. Maybe we shouldn't do your program. It's probably not going to be successful. And it's really hard to argue against a what if like that, right? You know, they could have been right, but we've had a good hunch that if we did a good job on advertising and tried to make it clear that we were, you know, actively looking for women, that we wanted their participation.
And we ended up with
100, you know, 200 emails and 100 applications. So there was obviously, they were wrong. And so I hope that one of the good things that came from that experience is that the next time someone tells you maybe women just aren't interested, you can say, well, look, you know, Chris and Hannah ran this program and there are 181 men and then there are 100 women. There's something kind of weird going on here.
And one thing that I want to add to that is that when we started to get these comments, when we were first talking about running the program, we were getting these comments, I would reply to them. And I would say, no, I really think we will be able to find women, blah, 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 blah. And I would try and, you know, have this discussion. And I guess after a few weeks of doing that, I realized that it just wasn't worth my time. And so at that point, I turned around and just said, look, just wait. Just wait and see what happens. And
I think there's really one argument that can be used to shut down that whole line of thought, which is we're trying to get more people writing free software. And the end result of all of this work that we're doing is more people writing free software. You want more people writing free software, don't you? Then be quiet and let us work.
Yeah, and I think that defending the answer those things too much is like the number one way to burn out and just become completely pessimistic and hopeless. Whereas focusing your attention on interested people who want to help has the opposite effect.
I'd just like to tell an anecdote. The quality of the applications we received, by the way, was incredibly high from these women who had not existed a few weeks before. A particular example, one of GNOME's projects was on Rhythmbox, which you probably, some of you have heard of. It's a music player for GNOME. We wanted to make a system where it would automatically make playlists for you based on things like moods or which songs you played in proximity to which other songs. It was a machine learning problem. And someone sent us an application that was kind of heartbreaking to read. She just finished her master's degree in artificial intelligence as applied to music. And she sent us this email saying things like, well, you know, I'm not sure if I can help. You know, I don't know if I can be of any use. And Felix was like, my God, who did you think we thought we was going to reply? And so the take-home message from that experience to me was that women are consistently undervaluing their use to the free software community. There's a great study that was performed on a CS class where they asked the men and women to rate themselves in terms of competence at programming. And we found that the women dramatically underrated themselves compared to the men. You know, maybe it's true, maybe the men were better. So they did a test at the end of the semester. It was a measured programming test. This is your programming ability. And they were the same. The women were no worse at programming than the men at the end of the course. So this is something we really need to think about when we're trying to do this kind of recruitment. And I think it speaks to the problem we were talking about with competition rather than cooperation in the original GNOME Summer of Code setup. If you ask women to prove that they're better programmers than men, they probably just won't do it because they don't tend to be that arrogant. There are some, right?
Yeah. I know. Okay. Sure.
So, if you have a project or with zero revenue, how can you identify who is disenfranchised so
you can fix it? Well, I think that it's not always a case of disenfranchisement.
If you have a project with zero women in it, how can you identify the sources of disenfranchisement in order to fix them?
I don't think that there was specific explicit discrimination towards women going on in the GNOME project. I think by and large it had zero women because it had zero women. It's not a very, it's not the answer we wanted to hear, right? We wanted to say, tell me what the bug is and I'll fix the bug. The answer is there weren't really any role models. Women didn't feel particularly invited. So the way we decided to fix it was to raise money to fund specific internships for women. We hoped that we would reverse what we felt was a negative feedback effect where we had no women because we had no women, and that we'd start to create a few women that could be used as role models. They could blog about the awesome stuff they're doing. Other women would see that. They would know that GNOME is a place where they should feel welcome to come and where we'd appreciate them. So.
A lot of times all it really takes is an explicit statement that, yes, we want you here. We value your work. We value what you're going to bring to things. There are lots of ways that you can contribute. And if you're interested in contributing, come and we will show you how. And then when you combine that with a statement that if there are things that make you uncomfortable, then talk to somebody about it and we'll see how we can fix that. Those two things together, I think, would really go pretty far.
Well, plus, I think explicitly inviting women you know who may seem interested.
Yeah.
It seems like there is a personal touch, that thread that runs through all of this stuff, that seems to make a huge difference. And sometimes just like, a woman who likes to work on Michelle, for example, and you say, well, why don't you just come join this IRC channel or something like that. And that can often, that's often project and they're like, oh no, too masculine, too much testosterone. I'd maybe do a few. but like most projects, I don't think people have that reaction to. And so it's sometimes just the case that they don't, they just didn't think about it. You know, it's not necessarily anything wrong with your project.
Another thing is if you have a project like Chris was talking about with the music AI thing, if you have a project that's for a special interest group that is not necessarily computer related, like music or you know, writing or whatever, if you go and find people who are really involved in the music community or who are musicians, or I was actually talking to somebody at LinuxConf AU who does Open Government Australia, and I suggested go find political science students, people who care about the thing that your project or program or software is working towards. Find them and teach them how to program, because you can teach programming. You can't teach people to care about the thing that you're working on.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because I think that a lot of free software projects draw from activist circles as well. And so I think that it could be the same basically for any kind of interest.
Cool. Let's see, we have about 7 minutes, so one or two questions, depending on how lengthy they are. Anyone we haven't heard from yet today? Is that, are you, Adelaide, or are you just flopping around? Okay. okay.
I don't have a very well formed question, so I'm going
to ask you. We have time? Go ahead.
I'm curious about, well, that means kind of all about the company and very well formed project. People get kind of scared off by it in a lot of ways. I think the Debian Women Project has done a lot in that direction. Great. What do you all think about Debian having a more broader diversity statement like that?
Yeah. Shall I just repeat the question?
Yeah.
Debian has a reputation of being a kind of scary place to be. The Debian Women Project changed that.
For women.
How should we consolidate the gains, I guess, maybe the question is?
Yeah, I was thinking like the Debian Women Project is great for genders.
I'm incredibly, impressed with the Ubuntu Code of Conduct. Ubuntu was really the first large free software project, as far as I know, to adopt explicitly this code of conduct that said, you have to be respectful to people. It's not okay to not be respectful for people. There are still distributions that argue about whether or not they should adopt this. Like, maybe it's infringing on our free speech rights to demand that we be respectful to people. but I praise Ubuntu for doing that. They have a code of conduct. It's very clear. They can enforce it. And I think that's a great thing that more projects should do.
Description that named them and felt like we would be aware of the issues surrounding, you know, their lives and things that they would reasonably expect to encounter in a group project of some sort. So I think that having a diversity statement that is not also backed by a code of conduct, whether it's explicit or implicit, won't really get you as much of a benefit. You'll have the people coming in and expressing interest, but without the code of conduct to say, essentially, don't be an asshat, you know, people are going to run smack into perhaps a culture that is not as diverse and not as aware of issues that are brought up by diversity. And you may get the attraction, but you won't get the retention. So I think it's important to have both.
And I think that, I mean, Debian is large enough, but I think that, like, individual groups within Debian could try this as well as a test, you know? I think that, you know, there are enough large groups like the Debian Pearl group and the Debian Games group and all these other ones. And as a test run, I personally think that Debian itself would be incredibly hostile to both diversity statement and a code of conduct. And while I encourage diversity, I don't personally feel like the code of conduct and those kind of structured rules are appropriate for Debian. I think they're great for other projects. I don't think they're right for ours. But I do think that the diversity statement would be interesting. And I wonder if it could actually work within smaller groups and then get built up as a cultural value. Because it's one thing to start that way and to start a project and say, we are explicitly encouraging diversity, we are explicitly naming our code of conduct. It's, I think, much harder, in my experience, to take an old project that already has cultural values basically completely entrenched and say, no, you know what, now you're going to be nice to people and you're going to welcome them and you're going to go out. I don't think for Debian it would work immediately, but I think that it could work on a smaller group level to be very explicit about that. I think that would actually probably be a very good idea.
Yeah, we definitely were lucky in that we were starting out a project relatively early, that we had incredible buy-in from all the early adopters, the project leaders, and also the people who were working on the specific project teams inside the larger project. Everyone had as a core value that we will uphold these values and the welcomingness, the diversity, the code of conduct, etc. I don't know how well it would work on a project that had those.
Yeah, I mean it's been around for 15 years. Yeah. I mean I think it's a much different approach with older projects.
Yeah.
Mm.
Especially really diverse. I think we have one more question here, and then we'll... What?
I have maybe a quick comment, and also I want to hope that Seth gets to ask this question.
Oh, Seth, do you have a question?
Yeah.
Go for it.
Maybe I'll quickly say mine, and we'll...
Okay.
I think that other kinds of diversity are really important. It's something really important to me. Am I the only non-white person? Well, you know.
No.
I'm the only South Asian in this room as far as I know. Turns out there are a lot of South Asian programs in this country, but I'm the only one here in this room right now. There's all sorts of other kinds of diversity that aren't physical, that I think are really important to pay attention to. So, Maka, that's awesome, that was helpful.
Awesome, and then Seth, I didn't see your hand.
One interesting thing, so I have a friend who, she's American, and she got a varsity letter in math because she used to go to math competitions. And I personally think that math competitions sound really exotic and interesting. And I had never known another woman who had done something like this, even though I know plenty of women who are great at math. And so it turns out that one of the things that made the difference for her was that she went to an all-female school. And so it seems like it might be something explicitly about masculine, and I don't know what it
there's
is.
There's actually a lot of research about gender and risk-taking, and entering into a competition is an inherently kind of risk-taking kind of activity, and there's a lot of research that shows that women are less likely to take risks, to engage in risk-taking activity, particularly if there are men around. And interestingly, if they're doing, this is exactly what Erin was saying, if they're in a single-sex environment, they're much more likely to take risks, basically.
I think also you can get some of the benefits of competition if you set it up in such a way that the social environment around it is more of a self-competition thing. You're challenging against yourself to exceed your own particular best previously, et cetera, instead of a head-to-head competition thing. And also when there's a social environment that makes failure acceptable. And that it's kind of hard to quantify, but having something where, if it is a community competition, having prominent people and people are socially respected in the community show that they're, you know, they have screwed up too, or they have failed to complete this too in the past, et cetera. Because I think having examples of how to fail or lose well is something that can really make competition a little less.
It's common in sports, you know, like you're kind of taught how to, okay, so you just screwed up. Well, you have to get back on the field and just do your best again. And I think that, I haven't really seen that attitude too much in like software, even though it's there and it's implied and I think people expect you to do it.
I think I've got an example. There's a website, stackoverflow.com. So Stack Overflow is a website for answering questions about technology, like how do I do this thing with Perl or Python? And people give answers and you can rate the answers. One answer gets voted on as being the best answer. Stack Overflow has a rewards system where it's almost like you're playing a video game and you level up in accordance to how good your answers are. And they furthermore type features of the site into how much reputation you have. So after you give 50 best answers, you're allowed to make comments on a bug, on a question, or close a question as being finished. You know, the right answer has been given, this question's over. And that seems like a perfect example of, it's definitely competition, right? You're competing for your score, but you're not trying to show that you're better than anyone else, like on an individual level. I'm not competing with this guy for the spot in a programming competition. It's really more sort of self-improvement.
How can I gain my reputation, or you know, like /.karma and stuff like that. You know, how many people remember the days when they would actually show the number of karma on /.? And you know, that sort of thing seems to really speak to the competitive monkey inside all of us. And yet, at the same time, it's not competitive. There are there's no one single winner. Everybody can win when they get to the certain.
I don't want to keep people from lunch, so maybe if you have a burning question, you can find someone at lunch. Is that okay, Toby? Okay. Because I want people to come back right at 2 o'clock, because we're doing lightning talks right after lunch. And they have to start on time, because they are very fast. If you submitted a lightning talk. Okay. Yes, thank you.